any first-time founder, I would recommend that just focus on distribution first. Of course, get the product market fit, understand where the market need is. But after you have determined what product you're building, focus completely on getting the right distribution, as much distribution as possible, and then keep on improving the product as you go forward. Don't worry about the vanity metrics. Don't worry about the press. Don't look for any external validation whatsoever, because at the end of the day, the paper, newspaper, which is criticizing you, or an investor who has not invested in you criticizing you, they are not going to sit with you and build the product.
Hello everyone, and that is my lovely guest Ankur Joshi. He's the CEO and co-founder of Nuclei. They are developing mobile solutions for banks and helping them completely reimagine digital banking. So in this exact episode, he talks about how he got this off the ground, talks about mistakes made in the early days, talks about why they bootstrap and have not raised any capital yet, talks about why the primary product is the team, and he goes on to talk about building partnerships, thoughts on the B2C and B2B business models, talks about why they think globally from day one and the tech hiring challenges in India, and talks about going fully remote and building culture. And finally, he talks about mental toughness and what he looks for in a co-founder. So please join the show. Thank you. Hello, Ankur. Thank you for coming on the show today.
Hello, Neil. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me on your show. It's a pleasure.
Awesome stuff. I'm very excited to speak to you today. Please tell the listeners what you're building.
So we are building a company called Nuclei. We are in the B2B2C space, okay, primarily, where we build products for banks and telcos. And these products are mainly used by the banks and the telco customers.
Okay.
But these products are distributed via the channels of bank or a telco mobile app or their internet banking or the telco website, right? Mm-hmm. So we are essentially creating products for the telco and banking industry, mm-hmm, but which their end users can use. So we are technically a B2B2C company.
Okay.
And in this space, we are building multiple products, because as a philosophy of our company, we want to obviously diversify our revenue stream across products, across geographies, across industries. At the same time, we are trying to solve multiple problems for our client base. Mm-hmm. So there are multiple problems which a bank or a telco might have, and we have multiple products which can satisfy or solve that particular problem for them. That's the space we are in right now.
Sounds exciting. What inspired you to do this?
Good question. So essentially, this is my fourth company which I'm building. Mm-hmm. The previous three, the last one got acquired by Amazon in 2018. Once it was acquired by them, essentially, a couple of us did not join and wanted to think about what next to build.
Yeah.
We did not necessarily have a product in mind, but we had certain guiding principles in mind. And one of the first guiding principle was that we would build something which will be sustainable in nature. Okay. So we wanted to build a profitable business from the get-go. We also wanted to build something which was big in size. So thinking global came to us from day one. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to build products which would scale up globally and not just be limited to a particular geography or a particular country. At the same time, we also did not, as I said, like we wanted to bootstrap and not raise external capital. So therefore, the root of B2B. During that process, so this is early 2018, mid-2018,
yeah,
we went around Middle East, Middle Eastern countries, South Asia, Southeast Asia, and met around 100-odd banks and telcos.
Yeah.
And essentially just tried to understand what problem statements they have and how can we solve their problem by using a technical solution, right? This kind of, you know, meeting to the next meeting helped us build our product idea together. So we kind of, from every meeting, we absorbed a concept or two,
yeah,
and built our first product, which was the marketplace product, wherein we, we also started building this product initially only for banks, because banks were in a position where they could they pay us upfront money,
yeah,
which will help us to build our team as well as survive as a company. And then also help us to build the product in parallel and then deploy that product across multiple banks. Mm-hmm. So we did that in late 2018 and early 19, built our marketplace product where we essentially become a platform for banks to integrate any third-party APIs. So it became a third-party API platform, which we deployed across 18-odd banks as of now, across both Middle East and South Asia. So primarily, there was no seminal moment where we came across that idea. Yeah. That idea eventually got together piece by piece. It was kind of a puzzle. We put together that puzzle over a course of 6 to 8 months. And then we started building that product. deployed that product across multiple banks. Slowly and slowly, as we wanted to build a sustainable business, we have been profitable from day one, from year one, right? So that is exactly how we want to progress as a company as well. And now we are expanding not just across Middle East, but also, and not just across banks, but also in telco sector, as well as across Southeast Asia and Europe.
Of course. And then in terms of stats, you know, how are things going? Can you share some stats in terms of, you know, transactions and customers? And
Sure. So we currently, as of now, we process around 3 million transactions per month. And these are the transactions which are processed across multiple products. So I said, like, Marketplace was our first product. Then we came up with our second product, which was around subscription platform that we are going live with a few clients in Middle East and Southeast Asia. Then our third product, which was around credit cards and overall card stack, that also we are going live with our third client early next year. So across all these transactions, so these are the three key products which we have built. That also helps us diversify our product portfolio, correct? And our also revenue stream across multiple products. So it reduces or hedges our risk, reduces our risk across a particular product, and helps us become more sustainable in nature.
Yeah. How does that make you feel then, those amazing stats?
So I wouldn't say they are amazing, but they're not bad, right? So they're not bad. We obviously want to go to the next benchmark, break the next glass ceiling. And for us, that has been a process, right? That wherever we are, how do we reach the next level in the next 6 months, 12 months? And that's something which we continuously strive, not only from a revenue perspective, but also from a culture of the company, from a personal perspective as well, not just for me, but personally for the rest of the team members as well. For us, how do we go to the next level? And I keep saying this internally, that the products which we are building for our clients, whether it is the Arise platform or the Marketplace platform or the card stack, right? These are the solutions which we are creating for our clients, but our primary product is always our team, right? So for me personally, as a CEO, my team is my primary product, and essentially that's something which I'm building. And if I get that right, then automatically my team is going to take care of the product, and consequently they are going to take care of our clients as well, right? So I'm just primarily focused on getting the team right, getting the culture right. And if you get that one correct, then the rest of the things automatically flow.
Yeah, let's talk about the early days. You specifically mentioned the marketplace. How did you get that off the ground? You know, how did you validate that idea of the marketplace?
So initially, we, as I said, like when we were meeting multiple clients across geographies, we understood that there were certain problem statements for a few banks in India who wanted to integrate third-party APIs.
Right.
But the time to market for them was just too high. And the cost to market was also too high, right? And then we realized that the similar kind of categories or products which a particular bank wanted, several other banks also wanted that same product, right? So that's where we saw that opportunity, that instead of each and every bank building on their own, why can't we just build something which can be deployed across multiple banks? It could be white labeled in nature, but essentially, the cost can also get distributed. So it's a win-win for everyone, right? And also, because it's a transactional platform, so there is transaction happening on a daily basis, hourly basis on this platform, there is some revenue which is also getting generated from that platform. So instead of our product becoming a cost center for the bank, it becomes a profit center for the bank. And that gives you a different set of moats around your business model, right? Because if you're a profit center, then it's very difficult to kind of disintermediate your business model. If you remain a cost center, then whenever there is a cost cutting, people question about why this product is required, right? But we always wanted to become a profit-oriented company from a client perspective, that we help the clients increase their revenue and become a profit center for them, again, in order to make our business model more sustainable. So the idea initially was, you know, just across multiple meetings, we heard the same different problems, same problems. And that's when we realized that, you know, we can create this platform and deploy it across multiple banks.
How long did it take you to get your first partnership then?
It took us around 6 months to sign up the first bank.
Was that what you expected?
I was actually expecting more. But we got lucky in terms of the initial few banks who we onboarded. We got lucky with the people who backed us, who supported us initially, bankers who helped us get off the ground.
Yeah.
And as I said, like, business is, yes, all about decision making, but a lot of it is also about luck. Yeah. And, you know, aligning with the right people. So we got lucky on that case, in that sense, in many ways, and across multiple banks, across multiple geographies. So that is something which I'm really grateful for. But the first bank took us around 6 months to sign up. Then after, I think the usual average sales cycle is somewhere between 10 to 12 months.
Mm, mm, mm. Did you make any mistakes in the early days then?
Of course, yeah. Many. Not a few, but many, many mistakes. The mistakes which primarily, you know, I was... So obviously, I mean, even before Nuclei, so let me go back a few more years, right? Yeah. So there were quite a few mistakes which we made in our earlier startups.
Mm.
And some of the key mistakes and our learnings from them became the guiding principles for Nuclei. So when I talk about that we want to always think long-term and we want to think globally and not just locally, right? Those were the mistakes which we made from our previous startup, that we were very, very local focused. We were not thinking long-term. We were only focused on the short-term, next 3 months, next 6 months.
Mm.
And that forced us to take short-term decisions, which were not great for us in the long run, right? So we tried and tried our best to avoid those mistakes at Nuclei. Some of them we definitely avoided completely, but few of them we ended up repeating. One was... definitely around, you know, building the right culture for the team. I think during the initial first year, we were too focused on getting it right from a revenue perspective and going to market as fast as possible, while not worrying or paying too much attention to how the team was shaping up.
Yeah.
So that was a mistake which we realized a bit too late, around 8-9 months into the journey. But we rectified it. It took us around 6 months to rectify. But we rectified that bit. The second mistake I think we did was that we should have gone global from day one.
Okay.
We ended up spending around 2 years in India and just focused on India. But then it's okay. I mean, in hindsight, everything is 2020. But that's something which I think we could have done differently. We could have gone global from our early days itself. But that's fine. We're going now. Mm. And again, like it's all happening now. So hopefully things will work out.
Yeah, hopefully we will. Well, it is working out. So you've done really well, amazingly well, on building partnerships locally and globally. For our Correct. Listeners who are probably doing a B2B startup, what advice would you give them? Obviously, you know, you've done lots of meets and greets, lots of schmoozing, lots of PowerPoint presentations, et cetera, et cetera. Well, you know, what kind of advice would you give our listeners regarding the B2B side of things? Obviously, it takes six to 12 months now, so it's, you know, it's not like a day one, day two thing, is it, really? So
Correct. So, incidentally, all the three previous startups which I built were all in the B2C space.
Ah, right, okay.
Yeah,
right.
One of the learnings from them was that B2C is an extremely hard domain to crack,
right?
And the other thing which is very peculiar to B2C is that it requires a lot of upfront investment in order to get that distribution. So when we were starting Nuclei, we wanted to not spend too much on our distribution, but leverage the existing distribution of a telco or a bank. And that's why we built a B2B2C product, where we essentially distribute our product using the bank's platform or a telco platform to their customers. And of course, in the process, share the revenue, whatever we make with the bank or a telco. But we were under no illusion that B2B is going to be easier than B2C. Right? It's just that the problem statements are different. One thing which a lot of startups, and when I was doing my second startup, we did not realize was that engaging with big organizations, their processes, etc., are different than compared to a startup. Right? In a startup, you're just 5 or 6 people when you start, and you can take decisions by the hour. But for an organization with 20,000 people, it's not that easy. They need to have those processes in place in order to make sure that the organization works, right? And as a startup, a lot of times I've seen many founders not respecting those processes, not respecting the structure which a big organization put in place. And because of that structure, the decision making sometimes feels slower, okay? it is not slow from that particular organization's perspective. Why? Because they need to be very, very methodical and structured around their decision making. But as a startup, of course, we are more hungry. We want to move very, very fast. We want to move and break things, right? But that can't be done for a big organization. So whenever it comes to B2B, I believe one virtue which every startup, a B2B startup founder should have is patience. Mm-hmm. It is not about closing a deal in 3 days or a month. It is all about thinking long term and building and cultivating those relationships, not for the next month or 3 months or a year. It's about building and cultivating those relationships for the next 20 years. Mm-hmm. If a person, a B2B founder, has that kind of a patience where they can wait for the next 3 years to get revenue out of a particular organization, or the next 2 years to get a revenue out of a particular organization, then it makes sense. Mm. Otherwise, there will be a lot of frustration involved, right? So from our perspective, today where we stand, our objective is very clear. We are not looking to make revenue from a particular relationship or from a particular organization immediately in the next 6 months. We are playing the long game. We're trying to solve their problems for the next 20 years, right? So sometimes we might get the deal, sometimes we might not get the deal. But if you look at the overall P&L of a relationship between Nuclei and a particular organization over the next 20 years, I think we will add a lot more value to that organization and therefore be sufficiently rewarded for that.
Yeah.
So as I said, like, we are playing the long game. B2B requires you to play the long game.
Yeah, definitely play the long game on that one. Yeah, you mentioned the team being your primary product. So talk about your hiring philosophy. You know, how do you evaluate potential hires?
I can speak about that for hours.
Yeah, go for it.
let me summarize it in one short sentence, right? So for me, the primary objective, again, with the team also, was thinking long-term.
Yeah.
Right?
Okay.
And this was clearly a mistake we did while building the previous startups. One of the reasons was that because we had raised a lot of VC funding, we went into that cycle of raising funds, spending that money, again raising the next round, again spending it, again raising the next round, right? So because our survival was not sure of after the next first 18 months till approximately the time for which that funds will last, right? So whenever we were even onboarding someone on our team, we were bringing in people who could add value from day one, right? So we did not care whether they were fitting in culturally, or at least we did not focus that much on whether they will fit in culturally or not. We focused more on the skill set rather than their attitude, right? And that was, in hindsight, one of the biggest mistakes. So with Nuclei, we were very clear that even with people, and not just with product and our client relationships, but even with our own team, we will think very, very long term. And that required us to choose attitude of a person over their skill set. Mm-hmm. Because skill set is something which can be learned if you have the right attitude. Let's say, for example, I don't know Kubernetes or Go language, today. But if I have the right attitude, if I want to learn, if I want to help the company, if I want to help the team, right, I would maybe spend the next 3 months, learn both of them, and start adding value to the team. Mm-hmm. So this attitude will help me throughout my life, whenever I face a new challenge, this attitude will enable me to learn that particular skill set and solve that particular problem. So we started prioritizing attitude over the skill set, focused heavily on investing into the team, both from a money and, more importantly, from a time perspective. So one of our goals or OKRs for the company, the first OKR is that how do we level up 75% of the team in the next 12 months, right? So we have levels defined, not from a promotional or title perspective, but in terms of the skill set perspective, right? Mm-hmm. So, these are the guides which enable every individual in the company to think about that. These are the tasks or attributes they need to have to go to the next level. And that's how their one-on-ones or on a month-on-month basis, they are able to track how are they performing from the next level perspective. Mm-hmm. So that has been our core focus. Again, as I said, like, if we get the right people who fit in nicely, who fit into our culture, it's something which is a long-term relationship as well, right? Mm-hmm. So we are not looking to hire people only for the next year or 2 years, right? We want to work with people who we can work with for the rest of our lives. One other key thing which we did, and again, as I said, like, it's a luxury which we have, and therefore we were able to do. because we have not raised any external capital, we were able to dilute 25% of our equity, founders' equity, and distribute it within the team.
Okay. Okay.
So, yeah. So, generally, people do ESOPs for approximately around 10% pool. But we ended up deciding that, you know what, we should be giving out more to the team, because if we are talking about long-term relationships with our team, obviously, their skin needs to be in the game and they need to be sufficiently compensated, not just from a cash perspective, but also with their skin in the game and having equity of the company. And we diluted 25% and distributed that to the team. And just 2 months back, we also started buying back. So we started using portion of our profit pool to buy back some of that equity and therefore provide liquidity to our team.
So if I work there, do I get it after the 1 year service or do I get it straight away? Or
So we did not do ESOPs.
Right.
We did ESARs.
Oh, okay.
We essentially went across the market, looked at various programs which people had running for their employee stock options or employee stock appreciation rights. Chose for, like, we listed on, I think, around 12 odd parameters, chose the best possible process for that particular parameter, and then implemented that in our policy. So people get ESARs on day one when they join. These ESARs vest every month, not so there's no cliff of a year or so, which generally is the case in ESOPs. So they vest from the first month itself, and they vest equally over the next 48 months. So they vest over 4 years, but equally across all those 48 months.
What's your management style then? Is it like, you must be hands off then, right? From what you said. Let them get on with it. So obviously some people are to completely the opposite. You know, they want to know what every detail of what's going on.
Yeah. So, I mean, of course, I would love to be completely hands off, but that's not entirely true, because being hands off or being a micromanager depends on the difference between the maturity between you and the other person about a particular task, right? So we call it task relevant maturity. So for a particular task, if a person who has joined or is working for me in my team, and that person's maturity for that particular task is not high, then it is my responsibility as a manager to handhold that person and bring them up to a level where they can at least do that particular task to at least 80% of the efficiency as me, right? So after that, I need to be completely hands-off. After that, if I'm micromanaging, then I'm not helping anyone at all, neither myself nor that person, right? So it depends on what is the difference in maturity between two people for a particular task. If the difference is very wide, then it is the responsibility of the manager to closely handhold that person and make sure that they gain that maturity. But once that maturity is achieved, they need to be completely hands-off. They need to provide that freedom to that person. But having said that, with that freedom also comes responsibility, right? And therefore, the focus more on the attitude of a person rather than the skill set. So if the person has the right attitude, they would automatically start taking complete responsibility of that particular task. So if that is happening and if they are mature about that task, why would the manager even waste their time in micromanaging them, right? So once that freedom and responsibility is sorted, that maturity level is achieved, there is not much difference in terms of decision-making about a particular task between a manager and the reportee, it needs to be completely hands-off relationship.
Are you big on remote working then? Because I've looked at your jobs page, pretty much every single job is remote.
Yeah, we went permanently remote last year. So we did not, like, truth be told, like, a couple of years back, I did not think that remote work was possible. I thought again, remote work has its advantages, but at the same time, it also has its disadvantages, right? Because you're not working closely physically with each other. The kind of camaraderie which you can build with people, or the rapport which you can build with people while sitting next to each other, is definitely on a different level, right? So there are downsides, but there is also a significant upside of working remotely. Obviously, let me tackle the case of COVID. I mean, of course, when the virus is around, we don't want to put any one of us in harm's way, and therefore we say that, you know what, we are going permanently remote. Until the time it is not safe to come back, we wouldn't even expect people to travel or go anywhere on company business, right? So that's one thing. But the other thing is that the moment you go remote, now you have the luxury of onboarding people, not just from your local geography, but from anywhere across the world, right? So currently, I think we are around 98 odd people, and probably we are working from 30 odd different cities, so across the world. So I mean that just increases your efficiency and optionality when it comes to building the team. So that's something which we are really enjoying.
Mm-hmm. But how do you sort of like go about building the culture then? You know, how do you sort of onboard new employees?
It's a different challenge. Mm. It's a different challenge. I wouldn't say we have cracked it completely yet. Mm. I mean, of course, we are nowhere near a perfect company. Of course, we have a lot of challenges on hand. Onboarding of new people into the team is something which we are actively working on.
Yeah.
I would say we are 70% there.
Right.
We still need to improve some of our processes, and that will probably take us another 3 to 6 months. The last 10% is going to be the most difficult bit to cover and probably take the most amount of time, but another 3 to 6 months and we should be 90% there in terms of onboarding of people. But as I said, it is all about getting the right people into the team and getting the right people with the right attitude into the team, right?
Yeah.
Once that is done, once everyone is set, everyone is sure about the long-term focus and everyone is working towards the long-term gain of the team, putting the team first before self, that's something which we absolutely is sacred for us. Mm. We don't compromise on that. Anyone who is behaving selfishly or anyone who is thinking about themselves first and not the team is not a good fit in our team. They could be good fit in some other team. I'm not going to badmouth anyone. I mean, everyone has their own agendas in life and a way of life. It's just that it's not fit for us, right? I mean, we are a very small company. There are nearly 7.5 billion people in the world. We just require 150 odd people, right? So not everyone is going to be a perfect fit for us, but we're just looking for those other 50, 60 people who will fit into our culture, fit into our team nicely, and are focused on the long-term growth, believe in the long-term thinking process, and then put the team first.
Put the team first. How's the hiring going then? Because I keep reading on Twitter, you know, Indian startup salaries are going through the roof. People asking for Ferraris and et cetera, holidays in Dubai. What's the word on the street? You're the perfect person to ask about this.
Oh man, it is tough. Like, and specifically, like I stay in Bangalore. Bangalore market specifically is very tough in terms of hiring new talent, specifically the tech talent, right? And because now almost everyone has gone global, everyone has that luxury of hiring from any geography, right? So it has, in fact, made the problem statement even tougher for us. For us, as I said, like, we are not looking to hire 1,000 people. We are looking to hire maybe every quarter the 6-7 people.
Yeah.
And what we constantly focus on and have been successful in, you know, attracting that kind of, those kind of people who are going to think long-term, who are not enamored by the fact that someone has raised $100 million in VC funding, but people who are impressed by the fact that we have bootstrapped our way to millions of dollars in revenue every year, right? And our goal is not to become a unicorn, because that's just paper valuation, right? Our goal is to make as much revenue and grow our bottom line as much as possible, as fast as possible. So we're slightly conservative in terms of not raising external capital. Because yes, it has its positives, but it also has its negatives, and we want to avoid that. And grow through self-accrual, whatever profits we generate. As of now, I mean, this is a question which has been asked to me quite often by people who I interview, that if you don't raise external capital, how would you grow? And we were just doing our projections for the next year, and we realized that the amount of capital we need to grow at the rapid pace with which we are growing is, you know, 25% of the profit after tax that we'll make in the next year.
Yeah.
So we have 4x that capital, and that's good enough for us.
No Ferraris yet then.
No Ferraris. No. Absolutely not.
Talk about growth, your amazing growth plans for the next 5 years. Where will you see this company grow? Yeah, I mean, you mentioned globally, so go.
So we are very, like, in the last 6 odd months, we started thinking that who amongst not just our peer companies, but companies who are far ahead of us, right? Who have been there for the last 20 odd years. Who amongst them could act as a good example for us, or who amongst them can we try and emulate, right? So there are quite a few companies we shortlisted, around 7 odd companies that we shortlisted. And we realized that if you look at 1990s, specifically India, you know, it was just after liberalization of the economy. 2000s, post the dot-com boom, there was a IT sector boom which came to India. The last decade has been all about startups and the B2C growth in India. And we've seen quite a few companies grow over the last 3 decades. But the level of globalization which we have today and the level of telecommunication which we have today, right? I think that amount of growth can be truncated into half of that time. So the companies who maybe started in 1990 and grew to a certain level by 2020, I think we could do that in the next 15 years. Mm. And that's what is setting us the benchmarks. That is helping us set the benchmarks for us as a company. We are, of course, working backwards and thinking that, you know what, every 3 years, we should be growing 5x. So I know it's not very aggressive, but it's all about being consistent.
Yeah.
And then compounding your growth year on year on year, right? So I would much rather compound at 50% every year over the next 20 years, rather than grow 10x every year and then close down after 3 years, right? So I would much rather compound at 50% year on year for the next 20 years, because the compounding impact which it will have after the 10th year or the 15th year will just be completely insane, right? And the fact that we are not funded, or we don't have any external shareholders on our cap table, right? That helps us in a way that whatever profits we generate, whatever capital we generate, right? It's going to be for the team.
Yeah.
It's not going to be for any external capital, right? And we don't have the pressure of providing exit, selling the company or providing an exit to an investor. We are completely, this is completely in our control, where we want to grow the company across multiple geographies, across multiple products, and grow the way we want it to grow, right? So I'm not saying that we are not going to grow very fast. We are completely focused on growing the company very, very fast. But at the same time, we are very prudent in terms of our expenses, and we are very prudent in terms of believing in the compounded growth value, right? That's what we are completely focused on.
Yeah, definitely. FinTech is absolutely booming in India. What's your thoughts on that? And
I mean, of course, look at the population of the country, yeah. Right? I mean, we have you have so many people in India who are might be on the cusp of, you know, getting onboarded onto the financial ecosystem over the next 5 to 10 years, yeah. Right? So that kind of human capital to utilize from a financial ecosystem perspective, I don't think it's available anywhere in the world right now. So that's where the opportunity lies, where so many people will come on board into the financial space. And obviously, there will be a lot of innovation around what kind of products you can offer to these people, because the segmentation of this population will be immense, right? Like you can't segment these people into 2 buckets. You will have to probably segment these people into hundreds of buckets. And the products which will fit certain buckets may not fit the rest of the bucket. So that's where the innovation will come in. There will be the segmentation in the market. A product will probably target someone who is, you know, top 1 percentile from a finance perspective. There will be a product which will target the bottom 50 percentile from a financial perspective. And banks have a role to play here, right? Mm. Banks definitely have a role to play here, not just as kind of a moral obligation to make sure that whatever is happening in the ecosystem is right for the people, but also from an innovation perspective. Why? Because they have the biggest user base.
Yeah.
From an ecosystem perspective, like very few B2C companies even come close to that number, right? So that's where we see a very, very big opportunity, because we are sitting in a place where we can build such products and distribute those products to the customers through banks' distribution channel. Yeah. Yeah. And that is exactly our playground, right? Yeah. And not just in India, but also Middle East, also Southeast Asia, and hopefully going forward also in Europe.
Last few questions then. As someone who's done 4 startups, you know, what's surprised you about your entrepreneurial journey? Anything that's surprised you?
For sure, one thing has happened. I thought it was going to be a much easier journey when I started in 2010. It's not easy. It's definitely not easy. Requires you to be extremely strong, not just physically, because you need physical stamina to work that hard for longest years, right? But you also require a lot of mental strength. That is something which I did not anticipate when I started. And it's not just it's not just my personal experience, but all the founder friends which I have, specifically in the last 3 to 5 years, a lot of people have at least started this conversation around mental health.
Yeah,
I think that's very, very important, because even if you are running a startup which is a unicorn, right, the kind of pressure you are under to raise the next round, to prove it to the society, to prove it to your parents, to prove it to your team, there's just a lot of pressures from every direction, right? And to cope with that pressure was something which I was not sure I was capable of, maybe 7-8 years back. Quite honestly, I was not under that pressure 7-8 years back, but I was probably not aware of that pressure. But once that pressure came around, it took a while to adjust to that, to adjust to those pressures. But I think mental health is something which surprised me a lot. Mental toughness, the toughness which is required for a founder, and I mean, obviously to the rest of the team as well, was something which was surprising for me. I was not expecting that. But that's something which I think every founder definitely goes through and needs to acknowledge that and tackle it head on and solve for it.
Obviously, you have 4 startups. I'm assuming you have different co-founders. You know, for our listeners, what should they be looking for if they're looking for a co-founder?
Look for someone you can trust with your life, quite honestly, right? Because it's an extremely tough journey. And then most of the time, there are many downs than any, more downs than ups, right? So you're looking for someone who's, one, not going to abandon you when things are not going right? You want someone, I like the saying goes, right? Like, who would you want besides you in a trench? So your co-founder should be that person who would not abandon you, who would be there when things are not going right. Because that's exactly when you need someone you can completely trust and who will fight along with you. So it's a different journey. It's a tough journey. You need people you can trust and who will work with you for the long run. So I'm specifically with Nuclear, I've been very, very blessed to have good co-founders and good senior team. I hope that continues for as long as possible.
Awesome. So, what advice would you give to our first-time founders? What should they be focusing on?
So, one of the things which we were just discussing internally, that what we have seen in general, right? Specifically in India, I'm not too sure about UK or European markets, but a lot of first-time founders are just optimizing for external validation by raising funds or just looking for external validation instead of, a good product market fit or distribution. Then we realize that a lot of second-time founders are just completely focused on product and not focused on distribution. And then we saw that generally the more mature third-time, fourth-time founders are the ones who are more focused on distribution rather than external validation or product for that matter, right? Because external validation, quite honestly, is vanity, does not really matter. Product can always be improved. But if you don't have the right distribution, getting that distribution after a period of time becomes exponentially difficult, right? So any first-time founder, I would recommend that just focus on distribution first. Of course, get the product market fit, understand where the market need is. But after you have determined what product you are building, focus completely on getting the right distribution, as much distribution as possible, and then keep on improving the product as you go forward. Don't worry about the vanity metrics. Don't worry about the press. Don't look for any external validation whatsoever, because at the end of the day, the paper, newspaper, which is criticizing you, or an investor who has not invested in you, criticizing you, they are not going to sit with you and build the product. It's going to be you, your co-founder, and your team, right? So those are the only people you should care about and their views you should care about. Everything else you should just completely filter out.
Awesome stuff. Anker, last question. For people who want more information on you and the company, what must they do?
Directly reach out to me on LinkedIn. I'm almost always active on LinkedIn. You can reach out to me on Twitter as well @_AnkurJoshi. Otherwise, you can visit our website at gonuclear.com and write us an email from there, contact us from there.
Okay, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you today. I really appreciate it, and I wish you all the best.
Thank you, Neil. The pleasure has been all mine. Awesome. Thank you so much.
Cheers. Keep in touch, and I wish you all the best.
Thanks to Anchor for coming on the show today. For more information, check out gonuclei.com. Thank you for listening and supporting the podcast. And if you're building something very exciting, then let's connect. Tweet at Indian Startup SH or go to facebook.com/IndianStartup Show. Thank you and goodbye.